I'm pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Dave Johnson. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks, Michael. It's lovely to be sitting here chatting to you.
Well, here we are in the centre of the West End in the beautiful town of Fremantle. You've been in Fremantle a fair while now, Dave.
Yes, I arrived in rough, I think it was 1982. It's all a bit of a blur now. I think it was 82, 83. Right in the middle of the America's Cup time, or just after. The place was full of sannyasins, so it was a really, really interesting place to be at the time. And I just always found it an incredibly accepting place. As a young musician, you know, I was pretty much busking at the time. I just found it really supportive, really.
So what, you were in your early 20s?
Early 20s. I think I arrived for the first time when I was 20. I was kind of going backwards and forwards at that time, going between here, Melbourne, Darwin, you know, all over the place, the power of the thumb. And always found my way back to Fremantle.
Tell me, going back to that relative youth, what was it about Fremantle that drew you then?
I think it was the people. I think I just found everyone very accepting. I felt like I found my people in a way. Coming from Geelong, you know, there was just my sense of adventure, sense of exploration, interest. Whether that's because it was, you know, a smaller town at that time and people took a greater interest in people around them, but I think it's, yeah, the people that I really liked at the time.
Now, Dave, you're well known around Fremantle and beyond as a musician, singer-songwriter, and you've been involved in lots of things in Fremantle. You've been mixed up with Clancy's and what happens there. You've mixed up with the Starlight Choir. You teach. There's lots of things to talk about. But when you found your way from t'other side here, to Fremantle, did you have a guitar strung to your shoulder?
Surgically attached, pretty much. I'd sort of wake up in the morning and play guitar,
I'd go out busking. What were you playing in those days?
In those days, I was kind of into Redgum, Goanna. That was 1980.
Solid rock.
Yeah. And for me, that as a younger person, that was quite informative, that song. It sort of changed my view on Australia and Australian history. And
it was a powerful song, particularly for such a, in a sense, a mainstream tune.
Yeah.
And where were you playing? You started to mention the word busking.
Well, I used to do a lot of busking in the markets, across the road from Old Papa's, or Papa Luigi's.
Yep.
So I'd go over there and we'd busk all Saturday night and then head over to Nunzio's joint and spend all our busking money on his three beans, he was calling them at the time, you know?
Yes.
It's just to get away from the liquor licensing. You call this thing a coffee.
A little bit of Zambuca?
Yeah.
And how did your musical career then start to develop?
Right, so after, the busking years, I sort of started playing with different people. I think Rob Finlay, he was playing in the Diddy Wahoo Daddies and he gave me my first gig in Fremantle, I remember. I was supporting the Diddy Wahoo Daddies. That was quite nerve-wracking at the time. But it was, you know, great fun. And then I guess from then on it was, the early fly-by-night years was quite influential, sort of. I started learning more about sound and working a little bit with Free OPA Hire. We had sort of open performance nights, the original music night, and then, you know, just a general open mic night. That sort of funneled me into, you know, playing with other people a little bit more. And then started being in bands. Some of the early bands I was in was Push Humpty, which is a great sort of pop folk band, driven by a fellow called Dave Weir, who was quite a prolific songwriter. I was playing bass. Market Band was another one where I was used to play in the Market Bar. Big tall Michael on the piano and my friend Shorty on the percussion. And
Market was a good place for music.
Oh, yeah, that was great. Yeah, really good.
And was there a band called The Fling along the way?
And then after that time, The Fling kicked off. Actually, Steve Barnes gave me that little contact saying they were looking for... Dave Himes gave me that contact saying they were looking for a singer. So I went along, had a rehearsal with them, and that started off probably 15 years of touring, doing all the big national festivals, Port Ferry, Woodford, and then a couple of trips overseas through England. We played at Cropperty, which was Fairport Convention's sort of main festival that they run every year, which was quite amazing. I had a...
Something of a mecca, I suppose, for festival goers.
Yeah, and particularly for folk, that folk world,
Tell me this. How do you define folk today? Is it different from when you started out?
No, I feel like folk is still, to me, people's music. It's not, we're not trying to, be commercial. We're just writing how we perceive things. I think that's folk music. Woody Guthrie, but even, you look at some of the early blues artists, I also see them as sort of folk musicians. Let the Midnight Special, they're kind of like folk songs to me that are telling a story of someone's life. And that's what folk is to me.
When you were a young busker, did folk figure pretty predominantly?
Yeah, I think I was always leaning towards folk music. When I look at Red Gum was a big influence,
yes.
and fantastic, the sort of political, social commentary, funny. Goanna, Loudon Wainwright. I always leant towards these folk artists.
Yeah, something to say.
With Fling, I sort of started getting into world music a little bit more and Irish music. So that.
The bloody Irish.
Yeah.
We've all got some Irish in us, it seems.
I think it's because a lot of our early Australian music really stems from Irish influences, Scottish influences.
Mm.
And sort of.
Lots of wild colonial boys.
Yeah, yeah.
But you got into writing, as I said, known as a singer-songwriter. You developed those sound techniques that you started to advert to. But what about recording? When did you put down your first record, as our friend Bill Laurie would call it?
Bush Humpty did a sort of 5-track tape at the time, which we were pretty excited about. We had we did it at Lee Buddle's studio when Lee Buddle was sort of starting out. Then The Fling did two albums, two CDs. And the recording process is fantastic because you do pour all of that energy, time and money also, because the equipment's so expensive and the recording studios are generally, pretty high-end businesses to run. But you're pouring all this creative energy into this one point, and it kind of, as a musician, it makes you feel like you've really created something you're quite proud of.
You can feel it, obviously, from what you're saying, and always fascinating to know how many takes people actually have to do. You hear about some artists who did the one take and this is the brilliant result. It's probably a little bit more complicated than that.
Well, it depends on the musicianship, really. And how prepared you are before you go into the studio. I love, with this latest album, Ian Simpson, who, is probably Australia's best banjo player, is just astounding. He does his homework, he learns the song, comes into the studio, He's there for 20 minutes. He gives you two amazing takes and says, Dave, they're slightly different, you know, slightly different feel. You choose. 20 minutes, like, but amazing. He's just an amazing player.
So this is your album that's about to come out, about to be fully released to the world, not just bits and pieces, but the lot. What's the name of it?
It's Inequality Boulevard.
Inequality Boulevard. Mm. I wonder what that could possibly be about, Dave.
Yes, well, let's see.
Tell us more.
I think, you know, I guess inequality, when the other part of my life where I'm working at Banksia Prison, I'm working with some of the most damaged kids in the state, working down at St. Patrick's Community Support Centre, running that choir, and we're doing it in the homeless shelter. You know, I just see this other side of life. And here in WA, we've got the wealthiest postcode in the country. And just, but you see it all over the place. It's throughout the world. But I just kind of really felt like I wanted to write songs that sort of stood up for the people who are really struggling a little bit more, you know. I've written enough broken love songs to last a lifetime, so this is a bit of a shift for me.
Well, that must be a challenge, one of the challenges for a songwriter. You can keep writing about the broken heart, I suppose, from album to album, and if people love them, they love them, and there's always another broken heart to be mended. But what in your case, how would you describe your first album when you came out on your own?
First album, Leaving Time, sort of again, because there's a lot of sort of relationship breakup songs in there, but there's also a couple of really interesting songs. History is one of the songs off that album, and History is again looking at the Indigenous history of Australia. So, which is timeless. And then it goes into the damage that, you know, has created with colonisation, and also looks at where we are now and are things any better.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because we're talking the voice, we're talking treaty, and it's hard to believe during our lifetimes, as I see it, so much has suddenly happened. The decision in Mabo comes down in 92 and seems to have released a whole lot of energies and hopes and aspirations that previously we could only dream about.
It's interesting, isn't it? They're little steps forward. They're little...
no, go worries.
Little steps forward. You know, I guess around all the politics of it is sort of, you know, the statement of the heart, I love. I think it's a fantastic statement. But at the core of it, there's this few sentences that talk about incarceration rates and, you know, things are really still stuck and then they're not getting better. And I just feel as a society, which is not really setting things up to fail rather than to succeed, and it boils down to money, really. I think we're just not putting enough into social services.
Let's come back to that topic in another way in a minute. What about your second album?
Second album, Clear Day, On a Clear Day.
Sounds a bit more optimistic.
It's not. A bunch of broken love songs. No, Clear Day is the title track is really, you know, it's kind of a song that looks at, you know, when you are feeling downtrodden, when you're feeling, you're just not feeling resilient at all. I guess the central message is it's just a matter of a moment in time and things will change, and you've got to keep your eye on that clear day. That on a clear day, things you'll see a lot further than what you see now, and that's kind of like the.
You have to know it'll come around again.
Yeah.
Now, you've mentioned, I've mentioned, you've touched on songwriting, and you've also talked about Bankshire Prison, which has unfortunately come into national prominence in recent times. But what sort of work are you doing there and with whom?
In Bankshire? Well, I'm working for an organisation called the Australian Children Music Foundation. And they are a great organisation. I think they put sort of working musicians in a lot of low socioeconomic schools and in a lot of the juvenile prisons around Australia. And I'm teaching guitar there, so I sort of go in there 2 days a week and I just work my way through the accommodation units and sometimes work during the education hours. And I work with the kids that who want to do it.
What sort of ages are we talking about?
And we're talking between, I think the youngest I've taught there is 11, and then to 18.
You can sort of wonder why 11-year-olds are in prison at all.
Well, again, you know, I think that's a systematic sort of problem that we've had. I think just having the wrong approach to children in overall, like, you know, this should be it's not a justice thing most of the time, it's a health thing most of the time, and there's got to be other avenues. And just this thing that, you know, all those kids coming from all over the state, the most troubled, and they just all come into one facility, it's kind of a tinderbox for trouble. So if the money was there to have facilities scattered around in the country towns, I think it would be a lot more practical.
Regrettably, a lot of the kids are Indigenous as well.
Yeah, it's a 76-70% Indigenous population, which are coming from 3%. They're 3% of the population. So that's an enormous statistic right there.
Mm. More than 100 years ago, lots of Aboriginal prisoners found their way, that is, they were sent to Rottnest and held there. It eventually changed, but in some ways we replicate history, don't we?
Yeah, it is, yeah, and that's I often think, you know, have we really changed that much since those days? I mean, we still have these problems and we haven't really worked out how to solve them.
You've also mentioned the homeless and the Starlight Choir. Tell us about how that all happened. Because you've been a director or co-director of the choir for some time.
Yeah, we've been running that for about 15 years. And
Amazing.
Yeah, yes, it's been actually really good fun. It's a great way to start the week with a good sing.
So how did it come about?
Started off as a bit of a TAFE project. I was working for Challenger TAFE. I can't remember what they were called at the time. And it was, the program was to go out and engage street present people at the time in activities like art, painting, drawing, and music. And we would go out into the parks where some of the crew was sort of gathering and we'd engage that crew in singing songs. It was quite a really interesting project. It's a hit and miss one because everyone's very quite transient and it was quite an interesting project. We were sort of breaking up the drinking circle and then trying to sidetrack that process and talk about other, you know, activities and sort of engage with those people who were in the parks drinking and at the time I met some, you know, there was some really lovely people, just really broken people, but really, you know.
What have you learned over the 15 years with the Starlight Choir? How's it evolved and what lessons are there?
From that early beginning, it became too tricky in terms of consistency. So we moved it into St Patrick's Community Support Centre. And from there, the benefits were that it really lightened the atmosphere of that centre on those mornings. It created a more of a, you know, just a place that people go into when they've got nowhere else to turn, you know. There's no money for food, no house to live in. Things are diabolically difficult. And, you know, there's also all those undiagnosed sort of mental health issues and traumas. And that's quite a difficult environment. So putting music in there, it's kind of really worked.
Everyone seems to love music. Is that your experience as you've travelled around as a young guy, getting older?
Yeah, one of the most enjoyable things in my life, and still are, is that, you know, I'm just sitting around a campfire playing songs with mates. You know, I love it. It's just the best thing. So I wanted to transfer that vibe into the homeless shelter. And, you know, and then I guess the choir sort of developed. We sort of, the core business there is to engage everybody in that room, you know, yell out requests and sort of, and also try and get people to have a bit of a sing, because it's a physically healthy process. Then we started doing shows in the community with our little core group that we've sort of got going down there, which sort of changes and all the time. But that was a really interesting process of taking these people into places like the town hall or the, you know, City of Fremantle events, and making them feel part of the broader community. Mm. And getting the broader community to see the other side of what St Pat's do.
Now, you've mentioned TAFE. Your, if you like, saving the world singer-songwriting experience has become a little formalised by going into TAFE, do they?
Yeah, well, I guess it was interesting. Working with TAFE, I did this tour with a good friend, Karis, and we went through Europe.
Karis Thompson.
Karis Thompson. And Karis, like, he's just a dynamo, and he booked this enormous tour where we're playing every night of the week, 6 weeks. I was doing the support and then singing the harmonies with him. So at the end of that, my voice sort of just quietly crawled out of my throat and went away to die somewhere. And at that time, I thought, I really got to give things a bit of a rest and start doing different things. So that's the way I started working for TAFE. I was working in, again, all music orientated, but I was working with kids with disabilities. I was working with adults with mental health issues, and all centred around songwriting, telling your story and putting it into song.
Was songwriting something that came to you early and easily? I mean, how hard do you have to work on it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I personally really struggle with it. It's a battle of, the ego, and in the end, it becomes a thing of faith that you just have to trust in it. Mm. But particularly lyrics. You know, I think lyrics is quite a difficult, has been always a very difficult thing for me to choose the right words. You know, I've got this little process now where I used to start writing a song and then I'd start attacking it as soon as I'd got 5 or 6 lines down. I'd say, you can't say that. Oh, that's, what are you thinking? But I've gone, no, just let your creative thing flow onto the paper and get it out. Doesn't matter how stupid you think it is, don't even let that enter your mind. And then I would go on more of an editing process and refining and chiseling away, and that seems to work for me in that songwriting process.
I can relate to that.
Yeah.
Now, you're also known to many people through Clancy's.
Yes.
How did that happen, and how did they get to know you?
Well, I guess, you know, I've always been a bit of a fan of, you know, Jim Fisher, all those crew. I used to go down to the Sea View a lot, and, you know, the Fishers have done an amazing thing for local music in Fremantle. An astounding thing. And not just Fremantle, but I think brought the hot industry as a whole in Western Australia, because what they do is that they're not after the, you know, the best band or the, you know, who's gonna, they want to survive as a business, but they really give a huge number of people a go, and I think for a sustainable music industry, you have to have a foot in the door somewhere, and, you know, some gig to look forward to, and Clancy's do that really, really well.
And for people who aren't so familiar with Clancy's, in this wonderful sort of almost community setting, near St. Patrick's Church, describe it to them. What over the years have you got there? Do you get there today?
Well, for me, it's always, you know, centred around music. Mind you, they're great people to work for. The Fisher family are fantastic. Tom Fisher, great. But it's always been, everything's about music for me. I kind of, it's in my blood and bones. And so when I'm working, I'm the sound engineer down there, so I set up all the bands, mix them, and it is just great seeing all this, particularly the new talents coming through. You know, we've always had it. There's always been a fantastic music scene in Fremantle. Sometimes I wish there was more opportunity, more airplay, more avenues for those songs. There's so many good songs out there that, you know, if they just had a bit of repetition in the ears of the people, they'd sort of resonate more. And that, again, that would all come back to places like Clancy's and sort of more people coming to see music. It's just the way it works.
I'm sure you have seen the live performance places around Fremantle over time. I mean, people know about Mojo's, which has opened up again. You've mentioned Fly By Night. There's been various places, some of which have gone, some of which have come back again. How different is the scene today, as you see it, from, you know, even 10 years ago or earlier?
That's a tricky question.
I mean, people lament
the past.
The past,
yeah. But again, you know, there are always places starting up, and some places will take hold, and will take hold for, I think the Harbourside is a classic story. You know, Book of Funk went in there, young band, and they said, you know, it was dead, the place is dead. It's chilly now, but they went in there and they said, can we play here? And the bar manager went, yeah, why not? And then, you know, there was probably 5 to 10 years of live music at the Harbourside. And then it stopped, and now it's dead again. They pop up and they go. It's just ones that have stayed there, I guess, is, you know, the Stone Crow, Mojo's, Clancy's, Sea View. Well, what was it, the Sea View at the time, then moved to Clancy's. Aardvark, but that's closing. But something will come up, you know, there's...
So this is the message, that it's sort of an organic thing, things change, they come, they go, they move from here to there. There's something in Fremantle that's driving this, though.
Yeah, and I think there's this bit of... that's why I think, you know, the young people, the people who go, hey, I really like music, I'm going to throw my hat into the ring and, you know, get a couple of mates together, and we're going to form a band, and we're going to look for places to play. And there's that sort of attitude in Fremantle. You know, there is a love for music. There's an audience, but there's also lots of kids coming through who are saying, this is my passion.
I'm getting to the stage now where I sample what's happening usually through hidden treasures in the middle of winter in Fremantle each year and different venues around the old city here, and such a wonderful mix and different genres that you get. Some old people playing guitar and singing country, and somebody else bashing out rock, somebody doing something entirely different. Have you seen, do you think there is some new style of music that's taking place? Do you, not that you would despair about it, but how different are things today from when you started out? You're still here. So
yeah, well, I'm still
the,
here.
You're the constant.
Yeah, yeah. Look, it's really, that's an interesting one. You know, I think back when I first came to Fremantle and the West End was really hopping, you know. We had Coakley's and Orient and quite a few venues, and what was that? Elroy Flicker and the Gutter Slugs and but yeah, music does change, you know, as you get older, and you know, I guess that this is the thing. I'm into folk music. I'm into sort of organic sounds and sounds that are made through, you know, a musical skill. But when I sometimes listen to a lot of the electronic music and experimental music, I sort of get a bit lost there. It's not, I guess that's not, you know, not part of my generation. So I can appreciate it, but.
It's really fascinating, isn't it? I can't believe that I actually like electronic music. I have to not so much confess, but there's something very pure about the sounds that people generate. It's, you need to be a sound engineer, I suspect.
Yeah, well, it's all about sort of shaping those sounds on a you know, computer software, and you know, it's still music as much as, you know, spending 5 hours a day practicing, you know, a skill on a stringed instrument, or you know.
Before we finish off, let's come back to your latest album.
Yes, let's talk about Inequality and
Inequality Boulevard. So how long has this been in the gestation?
I reckon I started probably writing some of these songs 4 years ago, 4 or 5. Yeah, I think one of the ones, Nauru, for example, you know, is really looking at and stem from that frustration of ever since Howard sort of pulled that tamper trick during the election, and ever since then I feel like our morals have just been, you know,
it's 20 years ago,
and that was 20 years ago. But that whole scenario suggests stated into that song, and I probably, you know, been thinking about it all that time, but the song arrived probably about 4 or 5 years ago, and that was probably the oldest song on Inequality.
What's the newest, do you think?
The newest one would be a song called Euphoria, and that is a very interesting song, that one. I struggle even myself to work out what it's about, but it's, the gist of it is that, you know, we have, as, I mean, humans, we always have these obsessions. You know, I think, you know, a classic obsession at the moment is what's happening with the Queen, and you know, all this attention that we're sort of giving it, particularly in our news cycles. But it's also obsessions that we have towards football, religion, you know, right through to patriotism, and you know, the way we perceive ourselves. And I'm just, with that song, I'm balancing that term of what makes us euphoric, and is it real, or in the end, does it make us a little bit dysphoric or dysphoria? And I talk about that, you know, pairing a euphoria with a drug addiction as well. You know, that's a big topic. It's a big one.
It is a big topic. I have to say, I'm reflecting on all of those same topics myself lately. I mean, you could get quite pessimistic about where our world and planet is going, the future of the human race? Are you optimistic?
Tough one. Yeah, I am. I'm optimistic, and I think, you know, well, we've just got to be optimistic, don't we? Yeah. And we've got to start making the right decisions, and we've got to stop letting, you know, I guess some of those invested interests have really got to pull around and go, we just can't keep doing this, we can't keep destroying the planet, we can't keep, we've got to put some of this accumulated wealth back into fixing things.
Dave Johnson, on that optimistic note, cautionary note, advisory note, let's conclude and invite our listeners now to go and listen to
Inequality Boulevard. Yeah, please do. It's going to be out this Monday. So on the 26th of September, it's going to be across all your listening channels, Spotify, iTunes, and all the rest of them. And also Bandcamp. Bandcamp is one place where if you want to support the musician, it's probably the best place to do it because you can actually buy the product or give them some money, whereas you're not going to do that through Spotify. You're just going to be paying for a subscription and not much of that. None of that is actually going to go to the person who's made the product.
So an important message there for our listeners, a really important one. If you can support an artist through Bandcamp, you're doing a really good job. The other streaming services, by and large, very small, minuscule reward for a creative artist who's pulled their heart out and worked on something for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
Dave, good luck with it.
Thank you, Michael. That's been really good having a chat to you. I've sort of even forgot what we were, the purpose. It's just been nice having a chat. Thank you.
Yes, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Good luck with it all, Dave.